You know how to do it? No, the recording is this, the red, big red button. Okay, so the prognosis on landmarks is still not very good because I found that we have enough things to do still. I'm hoping to get to the landmarks, but we need to talk about satisfiability encodings a little bit more, since we are out there anyway, and since there are enough logic people here, I think it's a useful thing to do it. And then I'll also talk a little bit about using planning graph heuristics with respect to partial order planners, and then we will discuss landmark heuristics. I don't really have much to say other than the paper that you read, and we can talk a little bit, but that's about it. Okay. I think the answers for the survey are trickling in. The last I checked this morning, there were like, I think, 5 or 6. Maybe there are more now. So when I go back, I'll, you know, summarize and send them to you, and then we'll talk a little bit more about those as need be. Okay. I did notice that at least one of the early people said my handwriting is not good, and I'm not at all very happy about this. So I put that right there so that you can read the whole handwriting, nothing but it. But anyway, what do you mean my handwriting is not good? Okay, maybe I should ask you guys to put the names just for that. So we went through this quickly last time. I just want to go through this once more, and then we will also talk about how we can get encodings, SAT encodings, without actually looking at planning graph. So we sort of blundered into this part, right? Remember, we had a planning graph and with mutexes, and then we found that you can do backward search on the planning graph. If you have mutexes and if you look for a subgraph of the planning graph that has no, that supports the goals, and then no pair of actions that are selected are mutually exclusive, then that actually corresponds to a feasible plan, so that you can actually execute in the real world and it will reach you the goals, get you the goals. Okay? And when we saw that, when we realized that finding a subgraph of a planning graph is essentially an NP problem, and we were actually separately generating special purpose search algorithms for this. That's what I think I was talking about, like, in, I don't know where, in one of the slides, I showed you the search, this one. I showed you the search, right? And this basically was doing this NP problem. This, you know, actually it's an NP complete problem. It's solving this problem by essentially picking actions, picking sub-goals, and then backtracking as needed and so on. And then even as we were doing it, we could see it's sort of like a CSP problem, right? Because you can think of these as variables, and they have all these values. And when you select the values, then you'll get new variables into consideration. By the way, that is a little point that we'll get back to, you know, in like a couple of minutes. First, we'll look at planning as SAT, but if you actually look at planning as CSP, one interesting point is, yes, these are variables, and when, and these are the values for the variables. That means any variable, you know, the values for the variable would be all the actions from which there are edges onto that variable. Okay, that much is good enough. But one funny thing, of course, is when you give a variable a value, suddenly new variables come into being. Okay, from the point of view of CSP. And originally, in fact, this has been called the dynamic CSP problem. So in a CSP problem where you start with a set of variables, and then when you give a variable a certain value, then additional variables become active. Okay, and now they have to be given values. And when you give them values, some other variables become active. And you have to give values to them too. And the constraints, there may be constraints as to which values these variables can take. which you couldn't have cared less when you were here. It's only after you gave values here did some of the variables become active, then their constraints become active. Okay, so when you convert into CSP, it becomes what's called a dynamic constraint satisfaction problem. And it turns out it's syntactic sugaring. In fact, we will notice in a minute that dynamic constraint satisfaction problems can be converted back into static constraint satisfaction problems. All you need to do is, if in fact originally the goal, let's say in this particular case, this is unfortunately bad example because each variable has exactly one value here. But let me talk about the CSP one since we are here. Actually, this is basically what I was trying to talk about, and I'll come back to that in a minute. So in this case, these will be variables, initial variables, and any action from which you have links to it, those would be their values. Okay, and the only problem is when a variable is given a value as one of the actions, then certain other variables become active. To capture that notion of becoming active, what you would do is you'll start with the original CSP problem, and for every variable, you will introduce a null value into its domain. Okay, and the null value has the property that you can always take null value and you will not get into anybody else's. So that means there are no constraints over you having null value and somebody having null value. Okay, the only thing, of course, the null value then, if a variable has a null value, that means it's some sense inactive. It doesn't need a real value. When I say a variable became active, all I need to do is there is a constraint saying that that variable cannot have null value, which means it should have one of its real values. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, so with just this one trick, you can actually convert what would be a dynamic constraint satisfaction problem into a static constraint satisfaction problem. Okay. So last time we were talking about SAT encoding for this graph, and then I will contrast that to the CSP, and then we'll go forward. So for the SAT encoding, what did we do? We said initial. So there's a whole bunch of variables, the propositions, and then the axioms between the propositions. The rules of combining the constraints between what valuations different proposition symbols can take. Okay, so you have, and then I also said the propositions correspond to the state variables indexed by the level at which they are appearing in the planning graph. So there is at RE0, at AE0, at BE0 are the propositions corresponding to the initial state, and in fact they all must be true. So in fact there is a constraint saying this and this and this. That means they all must be true. Okay, and similarly the goal essentially says that in this particular case I want in A and in B. This is some kind of a rocket problem. So A and B should be in the rocket. And so in A1 and in B1 must be true together. That's another constraint. And then the additional constraints are of the following two types. One is if you have a condition true at this level, then one of the actions supporting that condition must be true in the previous level. Remember, actions and propositions, they're all just propositions. Actions as well as planning graph propositions, they're all just SAT variables. There'll be action SAT variables, there'll be proposition SAT variables. Okay, and what we are doing is an action SAT variable at this level must imply that one of the, proposition SAT variable at this level must imply one of the actions supporting it in the previous layer is true. And if it's only single action, then you just write the single action. If not, you write the disjunction. Okay? So in this particular case, actually all of them have single actions. That's why I just said in A1 implies load A1, in B1 implies load B1, at RM1 implies fly R1, at RE1 implies, notice that at RE1, the only way you can get at RE1 is the persistence of at RE from the previous level. So that will become one more. Each of the persistence actions is also a SAT variable now. So if you convert any of these things, you'll get a huge number of SAT variables and the constraints between them. Okay. The trick, of course, in writing anything into a SAT problem is you write right number of constraints such that any model for the SAT problem will correspond to a valid solution to the original problem. So this is a reduction. This is what you do in NP reductions too, right? I mean, you converted the planning problem into a SAT problem using this. And if the SAT problem has a solution, then you should be able to quickly convert that into the planning problem solution. And in our idea, what would be done is that once I give you a SAT solution, then you will just consider what are all the action variables that have true values. And those are the actions that need to be done. That's it. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay. So this is one set of things. You know, a proposition at a level implies one of its supporters in the previous layer. And I mentioned last time that you can think of this as an explanatory frame axiom, in the sense you are writing a frame axiom here saying the only way something can be true here is one of the guys supporting it are true in the previous level. One interesting thing, even as you're looking at this, and that becomes clearer in a couple of slides, is the planning graph. Even if the planning graph is not there, you could have written this stuff. Just by looking at the library actions, you could have written, if something has to be true, you know, if I have a domain which says, you know, here are my actions. A1 can give P, A2 can give P, right? Then basically, if I need P to be true in some level I know that it has to be given by either A1 or A2 or persist. So I can always, just even without planning graph, I could have put this as a disjunction. What is the planning graph giving you? A, of course, is there all in front of you. And B, actually, it's possible that in the planning graph, A2 doesn't occur in this layer. So in some sense, it is actually simplifying the disjunction. You thought any one of these 10 actions can give it, but 7 of the actions can't even be feasible by the previous layer. And so in some sense, the planning graph encoding is tighter encoding. It's a tighter encoding in the sense it basically makes you realize that certain assignments won't even be possible upfront. The solutions would be the same. Both of them will have the same solutions, you know, a valid assignment for this kind of encoding or the planning graph based encoding would be a valid plan. It's just that this would be a looser encoding. A looser encoding means you are likely to go down farther, fail, come back. A tighter encoding would be faster. Okay? So that's one type of constraint. The other constraints basically say if you have an action variable at a level, then all its precondition variables must be true in the previous level. Okay? And so action in load A1 implies at R is 0 and at A is 0. This is a conjunctive clause, conjunctive constraint. Okay? So I got these done, and about the only thing left then is how many actions can be made true at each level? Are there any constraints? If I stop right here and I look for the valid planning graphs, valid models for the SAT encoding, they sort of correspond to your relaxed plan. Because you are saying any number of actions can occur anywhere. Okay? But you do know that only certain actions, certain combinations of actions can actually be done at each layer. If you're trying to do A1, A2, A3 in the level 4, then no pair of them should be statically mutex. So it's this last set of constraints are the static mutex constraints. I mean, those are mutex constraints. In fact, even these static mutex constraints, the static ones, you can look at the library and find out which are statically mutex. What do you additionally get if you look at the planning graph? If you have propagated the mutual exclusions, then you get a little more number of mutex constraints that are in the deductive closure of the original mutex constraints. So in some sense, this actually makes it very clear to you from, if you remember CSP, that mutex propagation is essentially just a constraint propagation procedure. It just increases the K consistency of the problem, the level of consistency of the problem. And when you increase the level of consistency of CSP problem, you're making it tighter. Okay? So, now the interesting thing is, this is actually the, you know, this particular SAT encoding is the later one that people tried. Originally, what they would try is that they would just essentially consider every possible way of proving the correctness of a plan, and for each way of proving the correctness of a plan, you can set up an encoding. And in a minute, we'll show that this particular encoding is a tighter version of proving the correctness of a plan by back chaining, or the regression-based proof. Okay? The only difference really is that it can be tighter because if you did the mutex propagation, then you know basically there'll be more constraints, and similarly the loser disjunctions become tighter. That means there'll be more constraints again. And if I can add more constraints without removing any solution, I should do so because that improves the speed of solving of the CSP problem. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay. When I'm not changing, so in fact, what happens is when I put a little constraint somewhere down. So, for example, you probably understand this, but suppose I were to just give you one constraint. You know, it's a very easy course. You know, by the end, you should do well in the course, and then I will decide your grade. So you would be thinking every day you wake up, I have really nothing to do for 571. You know, it's only by the end, and end is very, very far away. Okay, and then basically, if you start actually doing search in your head as to whether waking up like 10:30 in the morning every day from now until the end of the semester, would that still be fine? You would go all the way down, and you might find that would be inconsistent. You would actually fail the course. So then you will start backtracking and looking for a different assignment of your times during the semester. Okay, when people tell you the ABD, Albert dissertation, which some of you guys are, you know, essentially everything is fine. You don't have to show up. You don't have to come to the classes. You just have to do a good dissertation. And that's like one constraint. And what you had in your high school and grade school is that constraint has been split back into this week thou shalt do the following homeworks. Next week you should do the following. Next week you should do the following. By the end you would be done. So somebody else other than you, your teacher, was doing the constraint propagation. And you used to not like the teacher because, you know, why are they making me, you know, why are they structuring the course so much? I need the freedom. And to some extent, if the same constraint, with given that end constraint, it turns out that the solutions are the same. It's just that you can get the solutions faster by propagating the consequences of that constraint upstream. That's what mutex propagation does. That's what planning graph construction does for you. Okay? Do you understand that? And so you can give this entire SAT encoding now to a SAT solver, and it will solve the problem, and it will basically give you a model for this encoding, and that will correspond to a solution. One question that I wrote for myself here is, will we get non-minimal plans? What does non-minimal mean? So the question here is every satisfying assignment for this set of constraints going to be a valid plan for the problem? First of all, these are supposed to be theorems. You should be proving it, okay? But nobody really does, okay? Nobody really does in the SAT literature, SAT encoding literature for planning problems. Maybe one or two people have proved it, but normally people just say, don't you realize that these are sufficient, okay? So the one problem with that, don't you realize that these are sufficient, is that sometimes then I can say, did you not realize that we both were wrong yesterday? Right? And so it turns out that if you do this, you know, you will actually get every model for this encoding would be a valid plan. But the other question is, would it be a minimal plan? Would it have possibly, for example, redundant actions in the plan? And what happens is, that you notice that the only constraint for making an action true is that somebody is, you know, requires to be true here, so this action must be true. That's all. But then the action also can be true just because it feels like it. And if it does become true, then all it needs to do is its preconditions must be true. Do you understand what I'm saying? So this set of constraints will allow you, for example, to do all sorts of additional actions in the middle layer, which were not needed, because they are not actually supporting any goal in the next layer. Because, see, I noticed that I wrote it this way. For every condition that needs to be true here, one of its supporters must be true here. But to make sure that there is a minimality, I need to write another constraint saying for everybody who is, every action which is true, at least one guy who is supporting should be required to be true in the next layer. If not, you know, actions can become true in this layer, and of course the constraints only make sure that their preconditions are also true in the previous layer, which will give actually an interesting reason for some more actions to become true in the previous layer. So one of the interesting things that happened actually is when you make a SAT encoding like this, and the black box is a planner, which actually all it did was it would do graph plan, take the planning graph, convert it into SAT, solve it using a SAT solver. And it was doing much faster at that time than solving it using actual graph plan search. And remember, these are again bounded length solutions. Okay, so if you don't find a plan in the given bound, you increase the bound and search again and generate a new encoding and search again. And one of the interesting things they used to find is that the plan they will get, they will be done very fast, but the plan they will get would be oftentimes having 20-30% more actions than are needed. And that's not surprising given what you realize here. Okay, and so of course this work, actually this strand of work, then added a post-processing framework after your redundant plans are generated. Then you write another post-processing step which goes and says, hey, what are you doing here? You're not supporting anybody. Off you go, and you remove this action. And when I remove it, then anybody whose only purpose seems to be supporting this action, they go. Right? So you, rather than, so interesting question is, you could reduce the minimality, you can either stop generating non-minimal plans to begin with, or you can generate them and simplify them. And it turned out empirically it is actually better to generate the non-minimal plans and simplify them than vice versa. Now all of these you can have a little time project and try to, you know, prove to yourself empirically, but you know, this sort of has been done once. Okay. One question is, so since I'm talking about minimizing a plan, how hard is it to minimize a plan? So if I give you a sequence of actions for in fact, in this particular case, actually you have sequence of steps, right? A1, A2, A3, followed by A4, A5, followed by A7, A9, that's my plan. That's how the plans generated by this would look like. Okay, so what does minimizing mean? I told you one simple idea, like in this case, A5 is not supporting anybody here. And so you should be able to actually say this guy is redundant. And if in fact this guy's only purpose is to support preconditions of A5, this guy becomes redundant, they can all be removed. However, that is the easy case. If you are on the other hand trying to talk about exact minimization method, that means given a plan, you will be able to remove all redundant actions. That would be an NP-complete problem again. Because essentially you could have situations where you will have subsets of actions can be removed completely. Okay, if you are surprised at this, think about the following problem that actually is an interesting one in its own right. Take the normal blocks world, okay? Except you throw in color of the blocks into the mix. So in the beginning, A and B and C are on the table, and they're all red. In the end, A and B and C are A on top of B on top of C, and they're still red. Okay, now not only do you have stacking operations, you also have painting operations. Now think about the following thing. Suppose I give you a plan which says first paint A blue, then B green, then C yellow, then solve the problem and then repaint them into the correct color. Now there is no single action here which is doing useless stuff. If you remove the last painting it back into red, then the block won't be red. So he'll say, I am doing something useful. I am doing redness. Okay, so I get to be there. This is how organizations with inefficient employers are generated. You know, essentially, everybody seems to think we are doing something useful, right? So this action will be doing, I'm converting the stuff into red. And I am giving him what he needs, which is it should not be red to begin with. So I'm making it green just so that he can then make it red so that he can be happy. Do you understand what I'm saying? That's why actually complete minimization is NP-hard. However, you can generate polynomial time procedures which minimize the plans to some extent and which will still be better than nothing. So that in fact, if you read all of this, this part is what it's saying. Most SAT-based planners have a post-processing step that attempts to remove some of the redundant actions. Not all of them, because removing all the redundant actions is actually NP-complete again. Okay? Questions? Okay. I mean, of course, the reason SAT solving, planning as SAT has been very useful is, in fact, it's actually interesting to understand why is it that converting everything into a SAT and solving it using SAT solver is faster than actually doing this search, which was the original search that was being done at that time. And one idea that you can actually understand even now is this. If this was entire thing is a CSP problem, there was no real reason why you must first start with these variables, give them values, then these variables, give them values, and go in that direction. If you have a CSP problem with 100 variables, you can pick the variable number 57, give it true, false. And then variable number 64, give it true, false, until you fail, or in which case you backtrack. So the order in which you are supposed to heuristically select the variables may not have anything to do with the level by level structure of the planning graph. The level by level structure was to make us happy. It looks good. Okay. It seems harder to say, oh, I want this to be true, then that means something should be here that needs it, and something should be here that gives it. That kind of a reasoning is hard for us to kind of make a picture of. But when you convert it into SAT, that's exactly what it's doing. It basically, it's all like a big soup of variables. And then whichever is the most constrained variable, it'll pick that and give it a least constraining value and move on. And if it's a SAT solver, what it does actually, most SAT solvers either, you know, most likely will do unit propagation and see which is the best variable to pick using the unit propagation. Okay, so that's like an intuitive reason as to why converting this into SAT actually gave you more freedom. And in fact, there were people who said, if in fact converting into SAT is giving you more freedom, it should then mean that there is also an approach here which would work just as well. And so there are papers on searching over planning graphs which start in the middle and go both directions. So non-directional search on the planning graph. So that sort of is being done without you know, you having to do anything when you convert it into SAT. Okay? Okay. Now, let me also talk about compilation into CSP, because it turns out that once it's an NP-complete problem, you can compile it into any of your substrates, and you can do it into SAT, you can do it into CSP, you can do it into IP. And all three have been done. Okay, IP being integer programming. Okay, and they have slightly differing trade-offs. But let me at least mention the CSP one because we mentioned it in the beginning of the class. The only difference in the case of CSP is they don't have to be Boolean variables. They are actually multi-valued variables now. Right, and because they are multi-valued variables, then these will become variables and the actions will become values. in SAT, everything is a proposition, which would be true or false. Okay, in CSP, propositions in the planning graph will be the CSP variables. Actions in the planning graph would be CSP values. Okay, and as I said, the only and the constraints, the only constraints are the mutual exclusion constraints. Saying, for example, it's not allowed to give load A1 as the value for the variable in A1 and at the same time give fly R1 as the value to at RM1. That's not allowed. So that's a mutual exclusion constraint. Okay? And the only other interesting thing is this activation. That means if you were to give this variable this value, then certain other variables become active. To do that, all I need to do is upfront, I'll assume that for every variable, I add an extra value called null value. Null value or inactive value, okay? And in the beginning, everybody can be, basically anybody can just be inactive unless forced to wake up. When they're forced to be active, then they must take one of the non-inactive values. That means they became active now. They need to take one of their real values. Okay, so the interesting thing is the activation constraints basically say if it is the case, in the beginning, the only variables that must be active are the goal variables. Because, you know, you can't say, you know, I need certain variables, the in A1 and in B1 variables must be true in the final state, right? So you can't just, I can't just say they will be inactive too. You actually have to be active. You need to find some action that's giving them. So upfront, I will start by putting these two constraints. The goal variables must be inactive. Okay? And the requirement to be not inactive propagates. Okay, so originally only the goal variables must be not inactive, and that means they must be active. Okay, and if you were to give for in A1 the value load A1, then its preconditions no longer can be inactive. They have to become active. That means they need real actions to support them. Okay, so this just directly converts the original problem into a CSP problem. And if you have a CSP solver, you can solve it. And an interesting thing is, when SAT solving came out, as I mentioned last time, all SAT solvers assume declarative or explicit encodings. The entire encoding is actually written out. Okay, CSPs, on the other hand, have actually been written in such a way that constraints can be pieces of code. Okay, and you take your current assignment and submit to a piece of code, it says yes or no. Yes means you can continue, I'm still happy. No, I'm already unhappy. You may as well backtrack. Okay? And as I said last time, the reason SAT solvers died in the early days was because the size of the encoding was so big that just generating the encoding and writing it into the memory, you're running out of memory. That would not be a problem for CSP encodings because they can actually write many of these constraints as procedural constraints. Okay, and so in the beginning, when actually the one interesting thing is the CSP encoding was done by a student at ASU, you know, back in 2000, I believe. So much so that actually last year he got the most influential paper award, runner-up, because 10 years have passed. And so in, you know, back in 2000, a student actually did this, Mindo, and he was able to show that the CSP solvers were much faster than at that time's very best SAT solvers on the SAT encoding, which is kind of nice. However, unfortunately, it's also the case that SAT solving people don't sleep, whereas CSP solving people sleep quite often, and IP solvers people don't wake up, and you know, with all due respect, because they just assume ILOG will tell us when the next generation solver comes. SAT solving people are like busy beavers. They're just coming up with better and better solvers every day. Okay, and CSP solving people once in a while, maybe every 3 years, maybe you'll do a slightly better solver. So in some sense, Min, despite the fact that at that time CSP solving was winning over SAT solving, and in fact all the reasons for its winning are still holding true today, the memory requirements have slackened. First of all, we have much more memories right now. And secondly, the solvers have become much faster under in SAT. So there is still a lot more work right now in SAT compilation than CSP compilation. So if you are betting on substrates, you should bet on the substrates who don't sleep, right? Because if you are betting on somebody who is just as lazy as you are, I mean, remember, you're compiling because you are a lazy bum. You don't want to solve your own problem. You want somebody else to solve it. Then you should at least be smart enough to bet on people who are much more hardworking than you are. And unfortunately, CSP guys tend not to generate very good solvers every day. SAT, on the other hand, does. And you know, that's just the reality right now. Okay, there is no theoretical reason why that must be true. In fact, there are lots of theoretical reasons as to why CSP solvers should do way better than SAT solvers. But somebody has to sit down and write good solvers, and that doesn't happen as much. Okay, so that's about the story about CSP compilation. Is there any questions on this stuff? Okay, the only thing is, in fact, the connection between this CSP and the SAT is not that far away from, if I were to give you a CSP encoding, suppose if I were to give you a CSP problem, you can always convert it into a SAT problem. Okay, so for example, I have a CSP problem which basically says, here is variable V1, it can take values 1, 2, 3, variable V2, it can take values 1-, 2-, 3-, okay? Then the SAT variables will be V1 is 1, V1 is 2, V1 is 3. Okay? And then the constraints would then be written in terms of these propositions rather than in terms of the values. Okay, the interesting thing actually is sort of an ironic thing is in the planning literature you have seen that people are given propositional representations. At least the current day planners spend time trying to look for multi-valued representations. That's the SAS representation that you read in the landmarks problem and so on. Because the multi-valued representations, one of the advantages for multi-valued representations is when I write it like this, I already know that V1 can only be 1 or 2 or 3. If it is 1, it's no longer 2 or 3. If it is 2, then it's not 1 and it's not 3. Whereas if I write it this way, then I need to add that knowledge separately. Because you know, there's no obvious reason as to why V1 1 and V1 2 cannot be true at the same time. If you don't want them to be true at the same time, you need to add that as an extra constraint. Okay? So there is that ironic thing in the sense that people actually convert the Boolean representation. And this is, if you're following what I'm just about to say, I'm impressed, okay, because it's like a two-layer loop. They start with Boolean representation, take SAS from that, SAS encoding from that, which means they're converting into sort of like a multi-valued CSP-style representation. Then they generate something equivalent to a planning graph for multi-valued state variables. And then if they were actually doing bounded length planning, they convert it into SAT. Do you understand what I'm saying? So because the SAT solvers are faster. This should not be surprising because you might write your program in the highest level language, but in the end, you convert it into ugly Intel assembly language because that's what everybody is using right now. Whether you like assembly language or not, when the end, that's the one for which there are fast engines. That's what you're going to convert it into. Okay? And so they have relative advantages, and if you can understand why the different steps are being done, then you really got something out of this series of lectures, I think. Okay. Any questions on these two things till now? Okay, so what I'm going to do now is also tell you that there is no real reason as to why SAT encodings must come from planning graphs alone. Okay, that's how it happened in this class. And to make you happy, it turns out that actually the one of the best SAT encodings was corresponding to just converting the planning graph directly into SAT. But originally, 10 years back when both graph plan and SAT were competing, SAT were basically looking for any kind of an encoding. You know, this is not surprising again for people who do, for example, integer programming formulations of a problem. There can be multiple ways of encoding a problem into an IP program, right? And then you actually talk about which encoding is better. For example, you would say this encoding is tighter because its actual linear relaxation comes closer to the integer values, for example. Okay? This kind of an issue is not surprising at all for people in OR. Anytime I say IP, I look at him because he actually is from, industrial engineering and knows IP. Some other people probably know it too, and you should know it. But the interesting thing is the question of if there are 8 different ways of converting a problem into SAT encoding, which is better? That hasn't received much attention in SAT community before. But it has received lots of attention in IP community. And you should not be surprised at all that this is an important issue. Right? For example, if you take SAT to be Intel assembly language, sorting is the problem. You can convert sorting into Intel assembly language code in this thick a book number of ways, that thick a book corresponding to Knuth's volume 3. Right? And those are all the different ways of converting sorting problem into Intel assembly language. And they have very different trade-offs. Right? So it should not be surprising. You can't just assume there is one way of writing planning as SAT. Okay? I showed you one way, but there should be multiple ways. Okay? And so where do the multiple ways come from? And in fact, I once mentioned that SAT would be the second easiest way to solve planning problems. I hope I mentioned it. Okay? If you don't have the time to solve it yourself, converting it into SAT problem is the second best way of doing it always. Okay? And of course, why is that the case? It's because to be able to solve a SAT problem, to convert planning into SAT, all you need is a procedure for checking whether a given plan is a solution. And it is that procedure that you actually put into SAT. Okay? So what that then means is, for every way you can prove the correctness of a plan, there is a way you can write a SAT encoding. Do you understand what I'm saying? And not surprisingly, this is actually true for sorting too. For every way you can show that a particular sequence is sorted, there is an algorithm that exploits that way of checking the sortedness and, makes a sorting algorithm. Okay? Proofs of correctness can essentially be used to set up the encodings. Now, what does that mean? Suppose I was saying I'm looking to see if there is a k-length solution for a planning problem. Suppose in this domain, I have a total of n actions, a1 to an. That's it. So now if there are k steps, then in each step, some subset of these actions must be done, right? So upfront, I know that the first step would be either a1 or a2 or et cetera an, some subset of these. Second step, again. Third step, fourth step. Kth step. Okay? I already have my upper bound as to some subsets from here would correspond to a plan. Now if I pick some subset from here and I give it to you, can you check whether it's a plan or not? That's where the proof comes. And you will essentially put enough constraints to say that the set of subsets I gave you would correspond to a plan. Okay? And there are obviously at least 3 ways of showing that a plan is correct. There may be many more, there are at least 3 ways. One is forward progression-based proof. Another is regression-based proof. The third is causal link-based proof. Not surprisingly, there are at least 3 fundamentally different SAT encodings for planning problems. One is progression or forward encoding. Another is regression or backward encoding. And the third is causal encoding. Okay, and they've all been tried. Okay? And I just want to show you what they would look like. Here is a reasonably busy slide. Notice, the point of this is to say, think of these encodings essentially in terms of their commonalities rather than their differences. Okay, they all just differ only in terms of how they prove the correctness. They all start with this as their background structure. Okay, so for example, encodings based on the state-based proofs will require for the SAT propositions the initial conditions and the goals and the actions. All of them are propositions now. And they will start by saying initial conditions must be true in the initial layer and the final conditions must be true in the final layer. Okay, and then in the case of forward, and you do know that you don't want to have a step where nothing was selected. That way, and actually a plan of length 1 might look like a plan of length 100 because you picked one action and then said do nothing, do nothing, do nothing, do nothing, do nothing, k minus 1 times. Right? Okay, so a minimum extra condition is at least one of the actions at each level must occur. At least one, which means this disjunction has to hold. Okay, and then actions imply their preconditions and effects. So if you put an action in, okay, then its effects definitely hold in the next layer and its preconditions must have held in the previous layer. Otherwise, the action cannot be true. Okay, this much both these encodings use. And then after this, you then go into two different encodings. This encoding, which is the original encoding that SAT plan tried, the very first one that people tried, essentially says, basically the real question is how to relate the truth of a proposition at one layer to its truth in the next layer, which those of you from Chitta's group would say is frame axioms. The question is, how do you write the frame axioms? That's what is the difference, okay? In the case of forward search, essentially what you do is you'd say a proposition P, you think in terms of going forward, how does the truth persist? That's what you write, the rules about, okay? So you would say, if Pij is true, and the action, and a particular action AK appears in the next layer, J plus 1, then PI will also be true in the next layer. You write this constraint for every action that doesn't have an effect on PI. Do you see what I'm saying? It's just a syntactic thing. You look at what you are trying to, for each condition you're writing a whole bunch of frame axioms. You see, if this action condition is true here, and this action which doesn't affect this condition occurs, then this condition will also be true next layer. Okay? Now, the worry that you have is, if I were to write this action thing, then it's true that AK did not kill PI. What if AJ killed PI? What if some other action killed PI? Did you understand what I'm saying? So here is PI is true. An action that is occurring, A10, will leave PI true, so PI will still be true. That's what this constraint is saying. But what if A11 is also occurring, and that kills PI, and so because of which PI becomes false? Do you understand what I'm saying? That is not a problem because I write one extra constraint. I say only one guy gets to talk per step. Do you understand what I'm saying? This is a very strong point because, in essence, forward encodings will wind up getting plans which are sequential in nature. Which means, if this plan, let's say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 actions, it could be found in an encoding of size 3 by this encoding, but it requires an encoding of size 7 by this encoding. Because every action must occur in a separate layer. It's strictly sequential. Now, if you're not completely lost by now, you should be asking yourself, why can't I change this somehow so that I don't need this silly condition? This condition is making everybody be an enemy of everybody else. What you really would like to say is only those guys who can't really get along shouldn't get along. But anybody else can appear. To do that, I need to consider proposition and a subset of actions appearing, leaving the proposition true other side. And you need to then write this. Currently you are writing this. If there are 10 propositions and 20 actions, you are writing how many of these? 200 of these. If you have 10 propositions and 20 actions, and if you want to do my other thing, which is subsets, then you will write 10 times 2 power 20 subsets. So you will kill yourself by increasing the number of constraints. Okay? So the original forward encoding assumed that, basically imposed this constraint that no two actions, whether they are interfering or not, no two actions can appear together. This is like the serial planning graph that I mentioned earlier. So no two real actions can occur together. Okay? And so this is one way of encoding. And the problem, of course, as I said, is in this encoding, this plan would be found with a 7-length encoding. And as the size of the encoding increases, the number of variables increase. And if you want to keep the encoding size to be 3, then your number of constraints will increase. You pick which is better. Couch and Salmon picked keeping the number of constraints smaller. Okay? On the other side, this side, you would say, so this is actually proving it in the forward way, because as you are progressing, you need to see whether or not conditions that are true here will be true here. And then you are computing the final goal state that way. And then you will check whether or not that is true. If you do it in the backward direction, then what you are saying is, if PI is true in the jth, is not true in the jth level, and became true in the j plus 1th level, that means it flipped from not being true to becoming true, then somebody made it true. Okay? So I'll just say, if it is the case, I need explanation. Why did this happen? Why did PI go from being not true to being true? It must have been because in the previous layer, somebody just made PI true. And there are only so many guys who can make PI true. So some disjunction of them has occurred. So I would write, if PI is not true in the jth level and it became true in the j plus 1th level, it means some subset of A1 to AM, where A1 to AM, they all add PI, they have occurred. One of them at least has occurred. One of them at least has occurred. Now the advantage of writing the frame axiom this way is now I no longer have to say that only one action should occur at each layer, because each condition's flip is being explained separately. Okay? And so then the only thing that I need to write here, instead of writing this constraint which says no pair can occur together, I get to write no pair of interacting actions occur together. No pair of interacting actions occur together. Okay? That makes all the difference. Now, with this encoding, in essence, the SAT solver would be able to find a solution to this in encoding length 3, whereas the SAT solver won't find a solution for this encoding until length 7. Okay? Now, if you look at this encoding, this is basically extremely close to what graph plan encoding is. The only additional thing is, instead of saying it was not true before and became true, you just say if it is true in this layer, then either it was true before, which is the persist action, or one of the guys made it true, which is the non-persist actions that are supporting this condition. So that's all that part, basically this part, just you don't have to say not true before, you just have to say the persist action appears. Okay, that's one part. The second part is, rather than just say no pair of interacting actions must occur together, where the interaction is defined statically, you actually write the interaction for any propagated mutexes also, which are essentially starting from here, and if you do a bunch of constraint propagation, you will find all the graph plan mutexes. It turns out, however, that the standard constraint propagation algorithms on SAT don't give the graph plan mutex ones. You need a specialized constraint propagation algorithm just to get those. Okay? So since they already are done, you can add those also. And that improves the tightness of the encoding significantly, and you are able to solve much larger problems in the same time. Okay, so all I did right now essentially is I tried to say that it's not that SAT is somehow connected to GraphPlan. It is that I came to SAT encodings through GraphPlan, but I could have come through it in terms of proof methods. This will generalize. When you start doing conditional planning, you can say, if I give you a conditional plan, how do you prove its correctness? If I give you conformant plans, which all of which I didn't necessarily define, I'll define at some point of time. And if you want to generate a SAT solver for conformant plans, first you will need to know if it comes and bites you, can you say whether it's correct or not? Okay, so in any problem, you'll first check the correctness criterion. And the SAT encoding can always come as soon as you have a correctness criterion. That's why it is second best way of solving the problem always. It's ready as soon as you figure out whether or not the problem is correct. Then the question then becomes how to do the encoding more and more efficient. Okay, now one interesting thing is actually I noticed that I have already pushed past your levels of endurance with this, looking at your faces. So I will actually probably skip through this. There is a way of writing encodings which correspond to the causal proofs. That too can be done. Okay, and it's been done in the originally when Couch and Selman wrote this, they hoped that the causal encoding will actually do better than either of the state-based encodings. But that didn't work out fine. And in fact, I think another student from here actually showed that it should not be surprising that that encoding doesn't do any better than the other encodings in terms of size. You know, that the usual way you compare, the hardness of two programs in software engineering is the number of lines of code, right? Which all of us will snicker at, saying, you know, it's like the dumb guy's way of comparing. But if you are comparing two SAT encodings, one way you can talk about which will be easier to solve before you actually solve is the number of variables, number of classes. If some encoding has both more number of variables and more number of classes, maybe it will be harder to solve. Of course, even as I'm saying that, some of you who know the SAT phase transition know that that's bogus, right? Because if it is below 4.3 for a random instance, which is the number of classes by number of variables, then it's actually easier to solve. But more or less, just like software engineers assume that the number of lines is a good metric for the difficulty of code, SAT encoding people assume that the number of variables and the number of classes is a good measure of how hard it would be to solve it. And then they will make qualitative assumptions based on that, and then they'll also test it on some number of real encodings and see whether or not they're faster. Okay? Originally, the argument as to why causal proofs is better was based on the fact that there are supposed to be fewer number of variables and constraints, but then it's been shown later on that that's not true, and it's also been shown that, in fact, it's harder to solve, at least at one point of time. Okay? So I will skip that. As far as the causal encodings is concerned, and now this picture should make sense. Okay. By the way, this morning I just read this, so looking at these slides, so apparently Facebook, which I don't have an account on, is all blue, and do you know why most of the default background on Facebook is blue? It was just today, it was in one of the articles. So this guy Mark Zuckerberg is colorblind, he's red-green colorblind. So the only thing he could see when he generated the original Facebook was blue. So he put everything in blue. Okay? And so now, of course, you're stuck with blue Facebook. And the reason you are stuck with these blue slides is not because I'm colorblind. I can actually see all the colors. They were generated for a talk many years back when I had to give them with real slides, the photographic slides. And they told me that you should always have blue background for these slides. So that's why I generated them. So there's a historic reason. I like this because actually more light and people wake up. So this is the big picture of all the ideas that we talked about in the last, several minutes as well as last class. If you start with bounded length planning, you essentially can set constraints to encode the lines of proof and then you can convert those encodings, and then you solve the constraints. Okay? Now, when you are setting constraints to encode the lines of proof, for planning, you can do forward proof lines, backward proof lines, or causal proof lines. Okay? And then you have to solve the constraints. When you're solving the constraints, these are just constraints. These are they're not representation dependent. Okay? They can be converted into SAT clauses, or CSP constraints, or IP constraints. And then you can use your favorite solver based on, you know, which one you convert it into. Okay? So then you can have papers on SAT solving for planning, planning as satisfiability, planning as CSP, planning as integer programming. All three papers exist. And multiple, you know, follow-ups on those things also exist. Okay? And then if you have constraints, when you're trying to solve constraints, any constraint problem, one way you can speed up the eventual solution is to do propagation. So essentially, you would actually try to prove to yourself whether you can, given the current constraints, if you can show that the current constraints will entail false, then you don't need to do the problem. The problem won't have a solution. If you can't, then you will do some decision in one branch, and then you again do constraint propagation to see if you can die right there. If so, you can get out. You know, in solving CSP problems, proving that they can't be solved is just as useful as showing the solution. Right? Constraint propagation essentially computes the constraints that are in the deductive closure of the original set of constraints. Now, if you are into constraint propagation, what kinds of propagation techniques are useful? It turns out if you know the CSP literature, there is a general way of talking about level of consistency of a CSP called the K-consistency of a CSP problem. And you can actually show that mutex propagation gets directed partial 3-consistency for the underlying CSP problem. Directed partial 3-consistency. Okay? But, you know, this would make only sense to you if you remember what either you know or remember, or you will go back and read what K-consistency is. Okay? So this is really, mutex propagation is just a constraint propagation method. Okay? Now, if you were to do constraints, you put a mutex propagation, and you from here you take backward proof, then you get the graph plan algorithm. Then you get the graph plan algorithm with the planning graph. Once you have the planning graph, you can directly find the, you can write what is planning as finding the valid subgraph of the planning graph, which can be solved back into this way, either SAT or CSP or ILP, or can be solved by direct search on the planning graph. And the one that I showed you last class was level by level backward search. There have been many other approaches that were tried, including local search on the planning graph, where you pick a subgraph, see if it's already right. If not, then you remove some edges, add some edges, and see if it becomes right now. If not, do the same thing. And it's hill climbing your way to, you know, solution. And in fact, there was a planner called LPG, won the competition back in 2003 by doing local search on graph plan. And it was doing quite well in 2005 also, actually. Okay? So that's another idea. Now, once you have the planning graph, you can also make the planning graph as a basis for heuristics for conjunctive planners. Which also should mean that since planning graph is connected to constraints, an encoding of plans can also be made as a basis for heuristics. I haven't taught you in the class, but there are papers now which, for example, will start with an encoding, relax the encoding by removing some constraints, solve it. Okay, so for example, remember when I gave you the graph plan encoding, right? If I did not have this constraint, solving this encoding will be like computing the relaxed plan. Maybe it will be costlier to do it this way than to use the planning graph, but actually start with a planning, you know, encoding and removing constraints, relaxing constraints will give you a heuristic. Okay? And from the IP literature, this is not surprising at all. In fact, in IP, what you would do is you would have the difficult constraints are the integrality constraints, and you would act as if integrality doesn't matter. Then it will become a linear programming problem, and you try to solve the linear programming problem, that will give you a bound. And the first way to solve integer programming problems is find a LP relaxation, find the solution for that, based on that you branch both sides of the fractional solution. Okay, so that sort of a thing is also possible, and so the reason I brought this up is they're all connected, and your ideas for your, you know, if you're trying to do any work in this sub part, which is the planning part, you need to understand how each of these pieces connect to each other. That's where the ideas come from, not based on individual papers, because things to be done in that paper have already been done. And when people write future work, you know how you write future work. Any of you write papers? I mean, some of you wrote papers, right? It's like, oh my God, I need to write some future work. Let me write something. Okay, that's not really what you're going to do. Okay, and anything interesting that needs to be done from your paper, you will never write it, because the other guy will do it and get the paper. Right, so you would actually send them in the wrong way, right? If at all you know what to do. Okay, the way you get the future work is look at all the papers and look at the bigger picture. That's one way. I mean, it may not be the only way. Okay, that's how that connection is. And so if you understand that picture a couple of weeks from now, then you haven't forgotten everything. Okay, now I have 10 more minutes, and I would not get to landmarks, but I will complete the planning graph discussion. Okay, so there are two pieces that I left. One is when I had negative interactions, I said you cannot do relaxed plans when you have planning graph heuristics if you have negative interactions, because finding the relaxed plan would be like finding the plan. You understand that, right? So then what is the, and so then we were stuck with having to take the level heuristic. Level heuristic was basically the first level are the conditions are present and no pair are mutex. But the problem with that is that it misses positive interactions. That means if some subset of goals which are not mutually exclusive but actually have opposite side, that means they have positive interactions, they can, one action could have given all of them. Okay, you could be missing the positive and positive interactions, and some things actually have positive interactions, some have to be independently computed, and you don't count the number of actions, you're only looking at the level. Okay, what you need to be able to do is separate them. So here is an idea, one heuristic that was tried again by, you know, a student from here, and it's actually, you know, probably one of the few heuristics which was tried which involves negative interactions on top of the planning graph. And you can think of that as take the length of the relaxed plan. So, you know, you have the planning graph with mutual exclusions. You ignore the mutual exclusions, compute the relaxed plan. Take the length, that gives you a number. Add to it some penalty for negative interactions. Okay, suppose I'm trying to actually compute the set, you know, the value for a particular goal set PQRS. Then this is the length of the relaxed plan for PQRS. And if this assumes that it can take into account positive interactions and independencies, but it would not take into account negative interactions. So for the negative interactions, I will check to see among these PQRS, which is the pair that is like hardest, I mean biggest enemies of each other. And for them, I add a penalty. And the way you can think about this is delta PQ. You know, what delta PQ is, so basically I'm taking max over all pairs from the set PQRS such that delta PQ is the highest. What is delta PQ? Delta PQ is the level at which PQ are present without being mutually exclusive minus max of the levels at which any of them are individually present. Now, if there is no mutual exclusion, this and this would be the same. If you are still alive and awake, you would realize these two will be the same if they have no mutual exclusion. This is what I said earlier, that there is no difference between level heuristic and max heuristic for no negative interactions case. But when there is negative interactions, level heuristic is different from max heuristic. And the length at which they differ, the amount of difference is sort of can be made to be correlated, I mean, is sort of correlated with the amount of negative interaction. So what we are doing now is we are taking level of PQ minus maximum of level of P and Q, and that number is added to this. That will always be a positive number. It's zero or more. And you add that to the top one. And that way you increase the value of the level. And this paper by Xuanlong Nguyen on extracting planning graph heuristics, that the textbook also talks about that. That paper has a whole bunch of these kinds of ideas. This is one idea that works quite well, so I just mentioned that. It's not so much that this is the very best idea in the world, but I'm giving you an idea as to how to combine positive and negative interactions at the heuristic. Because the obvious idea of looking for a relaxed plan won't work. Because relaxed plan is already NP-hard if you have mutual exclusion. So I ignore them and get the relaxed plan, and then I add a penalty. And this is, we call this, I think, adjusted sum heuristic. Okay, so that's one idea. One point I wanted to make. And the last one in the last 5 minutes is another, actually, in fact, this was by a student from here, Carl Schoenlong, who is now on the faculty. And later on, he went on and did some statistics stuff, and he's in a faculty in statistics in Michigan right now. And then he also did this other piece, which is also neat, so I should mention it to you, which is partial order planners were conspicuous by their absence since the time I told you how to do search with them, right? After that, I was only talking about how to use heuristics for progression and regression planners. All the holy wars were only between progression and regression planners. What happened to the partial order planners? Okay, so it turns out that in fact these heuristics can be used for partial order planners, and part of this argument I already made to you long back. The issue is if you have a partially ordered plan, it will have a bunch of open conditions and a bunch of unsafe links. Now if you have a particular partially ordered plan in the search queue, you want to see how hard would it be to make it complete, right? And one way is to look at the set of open conditions it has and see how hard is it to generate, you know, achieve all those open conditions. Now, the problem is open conditions for this particular plan, let's say this is a partial plan for, you know, the one in blue. It requires P here, it requires Q here, and it requires R here. Those are the open conditions. But Q and R are both required in one place, P is required in a different place. So it's not a real regression state. Okay, however, if you were to ignore positive, negative interactions, remember I said this couple of classes back that if I was going to LA and you know, at the end of my trip, I would need some food to eat as well as some drinks to drink, but I might need drinks only at some point and food only at some other point. Do I stop every minute and then buy when as and when it is needed, or do I buy all of them in the beginning and hope that they will survive to where they are needed? And if I assume that I'm the only guy in the car and I'm self-disciplined and I won't just keep eating, okay, I can buy all of them up front and then be sure that they will be available when I need them. Whereas if I also have, you know, my teenage son, then negative interactions. He'll eat them up before we leave the area, and so I have to buy them again. Okay, so if I ignore negative interactions, then PQR, even though they are supposed to be true at different points in time, they can all be made true in one state before this plan, and you can assume that they will persist as needed. All I'm saying is this assumption, it's an assumption, but this assumption is no worse than the assumption that's made in the relaxed plan. Okay, so then I take the PQR state, compute the relaxed plan for the PQR state, take the length, that would be the heuristic value for this plan, heuristic cost for this plan. Do you see what I'm saying? So open conditions almost take the place of regression states. The union of open conditions takes the place of regression state. Okay, that's one idea. The other idea that's helpful is that if you also have mutual exclusions propagated on the planning graph, then you have essentially found unsafe links that will become unsafe later, but they look as if they are not unsafe now, but they are dead anyway. So think about it this way. Currently, I have a link SI to SJ supporting P. There is an action which gives Q and requires R, and it can potentially come between SI and SJ. Is it threatening this link right now? No, because you would think it will threaten the link only if it is negative P. So if it is deleting P, then it will threaten. But suppose in the planning graph, I found that P and Q are statically mutex. They're eternally mutex. That means the PQ mutex hasn't changed even at the level of levels, which means they will never ever be doable together. It's not a length thing. It's just they are sworn enemies. And so is P and R mutex. Either just P and Q are mutex or P and R is mutex. If any one of those pairs are mutex, then in essence, this is an unsafe link. So what is the planner which is ignoring this unsafe link doing? It will find it the hard way much later. You, on the other hand, because you know that P and Q are mutex, you can essentially realize that it's unsafe right now, so either you promote or demote, or you cannot go forward. With those two ideas, at least back in 2001, partial order planners could be made competitive with the graph plan, planning graph, the graph plan ideas and progression planner ideas. Okay, and then sometime later, they were then taken part. There's a planner called, I think, Long did was called REPOP. And that's interesting because the reason the name is there is because there used to be a partial order planner called UCPOP, universally quantified conditional effect partial order planner. Okay, and then when the graph plan came, people start hearing about it. And so when this guy did this, he had REPOP. He called it REPOP. Okay, and then back later in, I think, 2003, the same year LPG won the competition, another guy, I forget his name now, Hakan Yunus, did VHPOP, which is to a large extent, essentially a C implementation of REPOP plus some interesting additional extension. And it did not do well in that competition, but it was different from everybody else. So it was given the Best Newcomer Award, which is interesting in as much as if you realize that before the planning competition started, partial order planning was the mainstay. That was the old comer. Okay, and for the longest time, nobody was doing partial order planning. And then if you start doing it, then it becomes newcomer. This is what, so if you take your great-great-grandfather's clothes and wear it tomorrow, you would get the Fashionista of the Year award, because nobody has seen people wearing it for a while, and you will be the newcomer. Okay? But it's interesting to realize that these ideas can be actually used in partial order planning too. In some cases, partial order planning has advantages, and if the only reason you are not using is because it doesn't have good heuristic control, you can use it. Okay, so what we'll do next class is first 10, 15, or 20 minutes, we'll talk about landmarks, and then we'll move on to the next major topic, which is Markowdation processes, for which you have to read the Markowdation processes, a chapter. Okay? Thanks.